Hi, good morning, and welcome to the Delta Stewardship Council meeting. It is 9:01 on Thursday, May 23rd, 2024, and we are here at the California Natural Resources Building located at 715 P Street in Sacramento, California. My name is Julie Lee, and I am the chair of the Delta Stewardship Council. In accordance with our Bagley-Keene requirements, we're now going to conduct a roll call of in-person council members to establish a quorum. Emma, can you lead us in our roll call?
I will. All right, here we go. Councilmember Burgess.
Here.
Councilmember Damrell. I want to note that Councilmember Hueso is absent. Councilmember Maranian.
Here.
Councilmember Miller.
Here.
Councilmember Zingali.
Here.
Chair Lee.
Here. So at this time, we're going to move into a closed session to discuss litigation matters per Government Code 11126E1 and E2C. We anticipate this will take less than an hour, so we will be back with you shortly. Thank you. So welcome back. We're reconvening. We have nothing to report out from our closed session. And next, we're going to have Emma explain how the public can participate in this meeting. Emma?
If any member of the public is interested in providing public comment on any agenda item during today's meeting, please send an email blue card to engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov as seen on the screen. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item that you wish to speak on. When called, the clerk will unmute you.
Thanks, Emma. So we are on item five, which is public comment. This is an item for the public to comment on any topic that is not on the council's agenda. Any comments on items on the agenda will be taken during that item. Emma, do we have any public comments for items not on today's agenda?
We do, Madam Chair. We have a public comment from Gilbert Cosio. You may come up and speak.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Chairman Lee and members of the council, especially Mr. Zingali. I used to see you up there. I'm used to seeing you on that screen. You're a little different. My name is Gilbert Cosio. I'm with River Delta Consulting. I've been working as a district engineer for Delta Levee Districts for over 40 years. In that capacity, I've counted it up because I'm a consultant now as I'm semi-retired. I counted it up. I worked for almost half of all the reclamation districts during my tenure. I think 46 of them I counted up. Anyway, I just wanted to comment on your current rulemaking process to modify the California Code of Regulations sections relative to covered actions, certifications of consistency for ecosystem projects. This rulemaking process was briefly mentioned at your last meeting during the executive officer's report. Prior to about a month ago, we had not been aware of the proposed changes. During the Delta Levee Investment Strategy proposed rulemaking, we participated in discussions with staff and consultants and provided local information and feedback as the DSC was developing the rulemaking. For the current rulemaking process, we were not given the opportunity to discuss the intent and thoughts envisioned by the DSC and provide feedback as the local special districts that will be affected by the rulemaking. Although local reclamation districts may not always be a project proponent, the majority of the land described as habitat priority areas in the Delta Plans Amended Chapter 4 falls under the jurisdiction of local Delta landowners and reclamation districts. The only opportunity to provide input was a comment period that ended May 17th and a hearing conducted May 14th. Staff was not allowed to discuss intent, purpose, or effect of these changes and how changes would impact the local regulated community prior to the hearing or comment deadline. We find these changes to be vague, and therefore it's difficult to comment due to the vague nature of the changes, not understanding the intent of the changes. In addition, local agricultural reclamation districts are strapped for funds. And we find that these changes will add to the work required to complete and file and administer certifications of consistency for future projects. These certifications are already very time-consuming and costly, and without technical staff, local RDs pay engineering and environmental consultants to complete the process. We will be requesting additional time to further evaluate and clarify outstanding issues with staff and the council prior to the council adopting the changes. We will also request convening of a working group to further discuss the issues. Hopefully, the request for both of these items will be granted. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on a non-agendized item, yet very important item. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. We appreciate those. So our next item is our consent count.
Madam Chair, we have three additional public comments online.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for noticing that. Okay, let's go ahead and move on to those public comments.
Our first public comment online is from Eric Almas. You should be able to speak now.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, members of the council. My name is Eric Almas. I'm a civil engineer with Kelsen, Senek, and Nudek, or KSN for short. KSN, just like Gilbert before me, very active in the Delta. KSN represents currently probably about a little over two dozen reclamation districts in the Delta. So I'd like to make a few, at this time, make a few comments regarding the council's proposed changes to California Code of Regulations, Title 23, Division 6, Sections 5001 to 5015, as they relate to EQSEP system protection and management. The proposed amendments will significantly increase the cost to prepare a certification of consistency for ecosystem enhancement and restoration projects beyond what is estimated in the economic impact analysis. As costs increase and funding sources become more limited, it has become even more challenging for reclamation districts to fund levee system improvements and will be further burdened by the increased planning costs for ecosystem enhancement features. These significant cost increases may make it infeasible for reclamation districts to incorporate ecosystem enhancement features into their projects. In several sections of the proposed language, the amendments use vague language, which has already led to confusion on what the requirements would be if adopted. An example that will affect many projects is the language regarding reclamation district compliance with CEQA for future or current or future actions that require a certificate of consistency. KSN requests further evaluation and consideration prior to the council adopting changes to the Title 23 regulations. We request a time extension so a working group can be put together with council staff for further input from the public and Delta stakeholders regarding the clarification of the proposed language. Many reclamation districts feel that transparency has been a little lacking during this process and that further collaboration is necessary for the language to reflect the on-the-ground needs of the Delta. At a time when such a priority has been placed on developing multi-benefit and ecosystem enhancement projects, it is ironic and disappointing that we would want to make the process to enhance ecosystems more onerous and largely cost prohibitive. Thank you.
We have additional public comment from Michael Moncrief. You should be able to speak now.
Good morning, Chair Lee, council members. My name is Michael Moncrief, and I'm with MBK Engineers here today on behalf of the California Central Valley Flood Control Association to support and provide public comment related to the proposed rulemaking changes, as previously referenced by Eric and Gilbert. The association, as part of its membership, represents approximately 30 reclamation districts within the legal Delta and provides support and advocacy on issues such as this. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide verbal and written comments last week related to the recent rulemaking hearing. Appreciate Jeff and Ava for their work. The association does have concerns similarly to KSN and River Delta related to the proposed rulemaking and amendments. The critical element for most of our reclamation districts within the Delta is tying our projects to state or federal funding. Oftentimes, our funding is tied to multi-benefit requirements, but the primary function of these projects is for rehabilitation and improvement for flood control purposes, and the enhancement element is typically a very small component of those projects. As stated previously, reclamation districts are being chipped away by increased regulatory costs, inflation, rate hikes, and our capabilities to compete for these necessary and critical funds is being impacted by the regulatory burden and costs associated with applying for these funds and then meeting the requirements of all the regulatory agencies for flood control, critical flood control investments. These changes, along with other hurdles, add to the inequity for many reclamation districts that are already losing ground and competing with large state and public agencies for scarce funding opportunities. It is not clear to the association how these additional appendices and alternative analysis requirements will further advance science or opportunities for future habitat enhancement for those respective projects being reviewed under the consistency determination. In most instances, setback alternatives or evaluation of zones within the Delta are the most extreme examples of a district-administered multi-benefit project. Again, typically we're focusing on flood-related projects with a small enhancement element to them. This rulemaking will force an evaluation of infeasible project alternatives to be done with no benefit to the final project. Besides the numerous constraints on setback alternatives, there's limited alignment unless funding is intended for that specific type of project. We do appreciate any potential opportunities for extending this work window to collaborate with staff, and we always look forward as an association to any future opportunities to engage with the council and staff. Thank you. Thank you.
We have an online public comment from Deirdre Desjardin. You should be able to speak now.
Thank you. Deirdre Desjardin with California Water Research. And I wanted to raise the social science issues with the council's processes. So this is an example where their local technical experts with local knowledge were not consulted. And it's a profound equity issue because there's essentially no technical representation for local equity interests in the process of developing this. And I wanted to, I brought to the council's attention, there's another issue with the water supply reliability recommendations for Delta ADAPTS. There was a recommendation that the water board consider modifying water quality standards and water quality objectives for human uses. And the input from the technical input from the stakeholders I worked with, and I was providing technical representation for public interest and public trust issues, was not followed. We didn't support that, and there's technical reasons. The modeling was not sufficient to show that we can't meet the current objectives, even with climate change. So I was concerned that I wasn't even able to get information about the synthesis process. And because it was a surprise to me and to other folks to see a recommendation that most of the folks in our focus group didn't support carried forward. So I'd really like the board to not just be the council staff to not just be more transparent and seek to engage local technical experts for equity, but also be more transparent about the process and why these people, why the technical experts that represent local knowledge, that have the best interests of the Delta at heart, that have worked for decades advocating for the interests of the Delta, aren't being consulted, aren't being included. And I think you could do a lot more, but it would require some transparency and some willingness to do some self-examination. And I think that's just as important. And I hope that people shouldn't be having to come after the fact and say, we didn't get a chance to comment on this. Please open it up for us. That something's wrong. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments.
There are no additional public comments, Madam Chair.
All right. Thanks, Emma. All right. So now we are on agenda item 6, which is our consent calendar. We have two items on the consent calendar. The first is the adoption of the April 25th, 2024 meeting summary. And the second one is the consideration and possible adoption of a contract amendment with AECOM to extend the performance period to the master contract. And this was under resolution 2024-05. First, I'll ask the members if there's any need for discussion on either of these items on the consent calendar. Okay, seeing none. Before we take our vote, I'll ask if there are any public comments on any of the items on the consent calendar. Emma?
No, Madam Chair, there are not.
Thank you. All right. I will now entertain a motion to approve these two items.
Move approval of the consent calendar.
Okay. So moved by Maria and seconded by the judge. Thank you. Emma, we will proceed with the roll call vote.
Councilmember Burgess.
Aye.
Councilmember Demrell. Councilmember Weso.
Aye.
Councilmember Maranian.
Aye.
Councilmember Zingali.
Aye.
Chair Lee.
Aye.
The motion passed, and I want to note that Vice Chair Miller was absent for the vote.
Thank you. All right, our next item is number 7, the chair's report. This is my item, and I wanted to share with council and others that May is Asian and Pacific American Heritage Month. And on May 11th, it was a beautiful day, and our family packed up and went down to the Lock Asian Pacific Spring Festival. So I took a few pictures there that I'm sharing. It was just a lovely experience. I wanted to mention a few of the highlights of our visit, including the tour we took of the Lock Boarding House Museum, which has been a labor of love for the Lock Foundation in partnership with California State Parks. The goal of the museum is to become a focal point for the preservation and education of the Chinese immigrant experience of Lock and ultimately the entire Delta region. There are many fascinating artifacts from Locke's past, which are beautifully displayed with detailed signage in a historic building that shows a snapshot of what life must have been like for those living there in the 1800s. We also toured the historic gambling hall and the Chinese school. One of the other highlights was the singing and dancing performances. You can see some of the gals in their colorful costumes they're practicing. The beautiful costume and the skill of the dancers were really impressive. One of the crowd favorites was a bamboo stick dance where they had these large stalks of bamboo and they were tapping them on the ground and then banging them together. And the dancers would have to step in and out of the sticks and avoid having their ankles crushed by these bamboo sticks. It was amazing to watch. It was really fun. And they got the public involved too and taught some of the kids how to do it. So it was a great experience. Lock faces many of the same modern day challenges as other rural communities, struggling economically while attempting to preserve and celebrate its historic and cultural legacy. Lock is the largest and most complete example of a rural agricultural Chinese American community in the United States. And I just wanted to highlight it here and express my thanks to the work of all of its residents and the Lock Foundation to ensure that this unique and diverse area is preserved. I also wanted to turn it over to Diane Burgess for just a minute so she could report out on a meeting that she had this month as well.
Thank you, Charlie. Yes, I, along with the other members of the Stewardship Council, were invited to a lunch with folks from Metropolitan Water District who were up here in Sacramento for the, is it the Aqua? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I drove up and ended up being the only member of the council that was able to attend. I was able to attend with Jessica Pearson, Jeff Henderson, and Lisa Marie. Lisa Marie, thank you. Wyndham Myers, sorry. The people that were representing Metropolitan included Chair Ortega, the general manager, four other members of the board, and three other staff. And it was a good conversation. They talked about the challenges that they're dealing with related to, you know, all the different ways of having to deal with delivering water for 27 different agencies. And we talked about the Delta, discussed flows and the value of that. And there was also a discussion related to high seismic issues on the Delta. And so I think, you know, I've requested that we have some sort of presentation related to seismic activity and issues on the Delta. I think there's possibly some misunderstandings. There's some clarifications on the risks that I think would be good for us to know. And then there was also a discussion related to DLIS and the Delta Levees Maintenance Subvention Program and their support of it. So it was an interesting conversation, and I appreciated the opportunity to get to represent the Stewardship Council. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
It's one comment that everybody at MWD, when I saw them, mentioned that it was a very fruitful meeting. Thank you for all your work.
Yep. Thank you. Definitely. Thanks for attending that. Hopefully a few more of us will be available next time for that meeting. So our next agenda item, I'm sorry, is there any public comment on that item?
No, Madam Chair, there is not.
Okay, thank you. Our next agenda item is the Executive Officer's Report. So I'll turn it over to Jessica Pearson for that.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm going to start with an update on a matter that I would put in the category of Delta Plan implementation. The council staff recently learned that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is considering reversing its nearly two-decade-old policy prohibiting vegetation on levees, woody vegetation in particular, trees and shrubs. Since 2007, the Army Corps has had a policy that prohibited trees and shrubs on levees as a condition, I believe, of eligibility for some of their funding programs. So if you've been to the Delta, you can see how this policy would present a huge challenge for compliance for Delta levees, many of which are studded with historic oak trees and other plants and trees of habitat value for the Delta. The restriction stemmed from concern that vegetation could threaten levee integrity and as a result pose a risk to public safety. The anti-vegetation policy was opposed at the time it was adopted by environmental groups as well as state agencies who are charged with protecting and enhancing the environment. And the failure to comply with the policy can make a levee district, as I mentioned, ineligible for rehabilitation funds after a disaster. The Delta Plan includes a recommendation, ERR4, calling for the Army Corps to exempt Delta levees from this restriction, because this is a nationwide policy and Delta levees are unique, we think. So we view this proposed policy change as a step in the right direction of Delta Plan implementation, and we are definitely tracking it and engaging. There is some new research that shows that native riparian vegetation may actually strengthen the soils that form the levees and can protect against erosion. And then obviously we know that they provide critical habitat. So the Army Corps is applying this new understanding to update its policy. So there is a public draft of best practices for vegetation on levees, which is a guidance document. It's out for public review and comment at leveesafety.org. Comments are due by July 1st. So right now, staff are really actively trying to increase awareness of this proposal and of its comment period for those that we know we may be interested in commenting. And we're also working with legislative staff to ensure that their offices are aware. So we will keep you updated of any developments on that.
Just to add, that also helps. Some vegetation helps with cleaning the water quality, and it also provides habitat for wildlife, and it also helps cool the water.
Yes, indeed. I don't have any covered action certification updates. There have been none filed since our last meeting. We do have a comment letter that we sent on May 20th. There's a copy in your board packet. on this is for, to Yuba County Water Agency regarding their draft environmental impact report for the extension of the Lower Yuba River Accord water transfer program. So this is about water transfers. The letter outlines that the project does not appear to meet the definition of a covered action as it represents the continuation of an existing project, but that new water transfers through the Delta may be covered actions if they occur above and beyond normal operations of the State Water Project and Central Valley Project. So a copy of that letter is in your folders. In terms of personnel, we're excited to introduce Ruby Kale. Is Ruby in the audience? Give us a wave, Ruby. As a University of San Francisco McCarthy Fellow who is going to spend her summer with us at the Delta Stewardship Council, she's an incoming junior at the University of San Francisco with a major in politics and minors in public policy and Chinese studies. She started her environmental journey volunteering at the Seattle Aquarium, and she serves now as the founder and president of the Disabled Student Union at USF. So she's going to be assisting us with policy analysis, legislative tracking, and our environmental justice and tribal outreach here at the council. So welcome to Ruby. And that is a program that we have hosted multiple fellows over multiple summers, and always happy to be partners with that program. You have your outreach highlights report, as always, in your packet and your active projects list to see what's happening currently in the Delta. I do want to point out a few things from the outreach highlights report this month. April was a really busy month for us for communication. Some of the most popular engagement items on our social media were a video featuring our science funding manager, Dylan Stern, who is promoting the application period for our 2025 Delta Science Research Awards. We had our most shared Instagram post to date, which reimagined Delta landscapes as Taylor Swift eras. So apparently that struck a chord with certain demographic. And so all council posts going forward will have a Taylor Swift edge to them. Carly's happy to hear that. And then a blog by senior environmental scientist Miranda Tilcock that we published for Earth Day on the importance of science synthesis also received quite a bit of engagement. So thanks to our communications team for continuing to generate some great content there. We do not have a legal update today, but we do have a legislative update. So I'm going to invite Brandon Chapin up to the microphone.
Good morning, Chairlady and council members. So if you've been following the news, it's been a very dull week and month in the legislature. Not much to report. I will start with just a few, if I can get the slides up on the screen. I'll go ahead and start with just a few updates on bills that we've been tracking. This week is the deadline for bills to get out of their house of origin. So if they do not pass on to the Senate by Friday, they will die for this year. It's the end of a 2-year session. So it's the very last chance for bills to advance. So there's been a few updates based on that. So the first is maybe. If I can get the next slide, please. Oh, while we wait for, doesn't seem to be responding. Oh, the first one is AB 2614. You'll remember that I mentioned this last month. This is from Assemblymember Ramos and deals with the water quality control plans that the Water Board puts together. This would have required the Water Board to consider tribal beneficial uses in its basin plans. This bill died on the Assembly suspense file. Our next one is SB 586. This is actually from Senator Eggman, and this one has actually been one that I've been reporting on for, I believe, over a year now. This would extend both Mossdale Track in the Delta and the city of West Sacramento's deadline to meet an urban level of flood protection from 2028 and 2030, respectively, to 2040 for both of them. The one addition since this bill has moved is that it does require every 5 years for both of those flood agencies to report to the legislature on progress made. But this was signed by Governor Newsom a couple of weeks ago. And it also has an urgency clause, so that went into effect immediately. And then the last bill I'll mention is, and this is related to SB 586, is SB 1139. This is from Senator Ashby and is very similar to 586 in that it gives the city of Sacramento an extension to the urban flood protection deadline from 2025 to 2030. However, this bill died in policy committee without a hearing, so that one also will not be advancing this year. Any questions on any of those bills or any of the other bills in the packets? Most of the bills have just been slowly advancing through the legislature.
Just one quick question I have, if possible, on the first bill on the water quality tribal communities. How often does that get updated, the plan itself? I know it's 5 years, 10 years, something like that.
Yeah, we do have the Delta Water Master who might be able to give a more specific answer on that, but sure. I believe it's every 5 years. Okay, it's every 5 years.
5 years, yeah. Because I remember a lot of stuff is stuck because they're expecting the updating before a lot of things happens. So that's why I'm asking. Okay, gotcha. Once every 5 years.
Yes. Well, 5 years and then every 3 years after that is what it sounds like. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? All right. And then the big news, of course, from Sacramento is the release of the 2024 May revised budget by Governor Newsom. This was a couple weeks ago on May 10th. If you remember back in January, the governor released a budget with an estimated shortfall of about $38 billion. Since then, the governor and the legislature have enacted about $17 billion worth of early action. So these are fund shifts and various other payment delays and other changes to address the budget shortfall immediately before the May revise was released. However, with the May revise, the governor also mentioned that there is a $27.6 billion additional shortfall, which for a total, if you take the early actions and the what's addressed in the budget, for a total of about $44.9 billion. To address that shortfall, the governor proposed quite a few actions. This includes using about $4.2 billion in reserves, some efficiencies, reductions, pauses on program expansions, and then other various revenue adjustments and borrowing. I should also mention at that second point there on the slide, this budget does attempt to address 2 years of shortfall. So this upcoming fiscal year's budget plus 25-26. And 25-26 is estimated to have another $28.4 billion in shortfall. Of note, just for the council's awareness, there are quite a few things. So the first is that the governor does propose a 7.95% budget reduction for all departments, as well as a vacant position sweep of about 10,000 positions. The council is still awaiting, one, just the budget going through the process, and then two, Department of Finance direction for how that's going to be implemented going forward, and we'll provide more details later. Also of note is a fund shift related to the Delta Levy Subventions Program. So there is a spring finance letter for the budget that proposes to shift about $5.2 million in Proposition 1 local assistance funding to state operations for the program. So that's primarily administration, so that's staffing for the program. And it's the council's understanding that the subventions program local assistance has funding for the next fiscal year, but after that is unclear going forward. And in regards to the bond, to bonds, still awaiting any word on bond movement. The legislature has, and the governor both have, until June 27th to pass any bond measures and sign them to get them on to the ballot going forward. So should have a more detailed update in June. With that is the budget, and that's my report. So I'll open it up to any other questions.
So as a county representative working on our budget, I'm hearing that beyond 25-26, it still looks pretty brutal as far as revenue and budget. So I think this is going to be continuing for a while.
Yep. Yeah, that's from both. Yeah, the Department of Finance and the Legislative Analyst Office have both projected that. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Jessica, was there anything else I mean important?
Thank you, Brandon. I'll just go ahead and foreshadow the rest of the agenda. So we'll hear from the Delta lead scientists on their lead scientist report. We'll also get an analysis of the Department of Water Resources' recently submitted levy investments report, which is under the purview of our Delta levy investment strategy. We're going to get an update from the Delta Water Master, and then a presentation on progress to date of the Pacific Flyway Center project. This was a covered action that was certified consistent with the Delta plan back in 2021, and it's a proposed nature and interpretive center near Fairfield. So that concludes my report. I'm happy to take any questions or go to public comment. Thank you very much.
I don't think the council members have any questions. Emma, are there any public comments?
Yes, we have a public comment from Deirdre Desjardins. You should be able to speak now.
Yeah, Deirdre Desjardins with California Water Research. And I wanted to say that it's really unfortunate that the deadline for providing 1 in 200 year flood protection for West Sacramento and Mossdale Tract got pushed back. This is particularly Stockton does, the federally authorized flood control project for Stockton doesn't adequately consider climate change. And so the new estimates show there's much higher flood flows. It's a huge risk. And they're expanding the bullseye by continuing to build and kicking a can down the road. There is a flood-resistant architecture that can be built that has a raised first floor or doesn't have habitable uses on the first floor, has like parking or storage. And we have to be facing the reality. If you see what happened around the world with extreme flooding, in 2022 and 2023, and it's just staggering. And we had extreme precipitation in Southern California this year. I think it's going to hit sooner than later. And it's politically inconvenient. Developers have a lot of sway, but I think that's one of the most important things that the council did was have regulations that required new development to meet standards for sea level rise. And we're just not facing it. So I see this as Senator Eggman utterly failing to grapple with the existential threat to Stockton from accelerating flood risks and accelerating sea level rise. And I think the legislature doesn't really grasp the danger from climate change. So thank you. And I hope the council will consider these risks going forward.
Thank you.
There are no additional public comments, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Emma. All right. So our next agenda item is our lead scientist report. So I will introduce Dr. Lisa Marie Windham Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we have a figure coming for this particular paper. So we're going to talk about drought. I know this isn't really the year yet, not looking that bad, but we know that's part of the long-term record and we do need to talk about it. And the title's great. So Dry Me a River, Ecological Effects in the Upper San Francisco Estuary otherwise known as the Delta and Susun region. And so some things to highlight about this particular paper are the fact that it's coming from the Interagency Ecological Program, which is, you know, they just had their meeting here about a month ago. I think you might recall it was the same week as the council meeting. It's a wonderful opportunity for cross-agency synthesis and discussion of advances in science and how to move forward. They really push forward on synthesis. This particular group is the drought synthesis team, and there's 24 people across agencies, so Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Water Resources, USGS, State Water Board, Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they made good use of 40 years of historical data, actually 50 going back for some of the data. And so what they were able to do was pull together all those data, not model responses, but data responses, and analyze them with additive models, with regressions, and look at patterns that you find when we have drought events. And they define drought as about two consecutive years of drought, of low. There's three kinds of drought, just to be clear. There's meteorological drought, which means less low rainfall, which generally leads to low river flows. That's hydrological drought. And then the third is called sociological drought. And that is basically less water for human use. So things like salinity impacts and such. So this drought synthesis team focused on hydrological drought with something called the Sacramento Valley Index, which is a record that we have going back in time. And they were able to tie these records of drought to ecological data that had been collected in these five regions that you can see in the third tier of this graphic. There's a lot of lumping of the data that they had to do. So they lumped by seasons, they lumped by regions, these five specific regions, and found very clear, distinct data trends that show where the reduction in flows during drought conditions lead to increases in residence time, lead to decreases in transport, and they're often coupled with higher air temperatures. But what they really were able to show was how those hypothetical hydrologic connections then lead to intermediate drivers of ecological effects like habitat connectivity, so floodplain connection with the rivers, how it affected salinity distribution, water clarity. And you can see from the colors in the second tier of this graphic how each of those issues of concern were related to the hydrological drivers. So for example, the habitat and salinity responses were strongly affected by transport. They believe they were the water clarity seemed to be an issue of residence time, basically how long the water is sitting there. There's a lot of clear quantifiable metrics I can discuss if you're interested. But the bottom line was that they were able to show convincingly that flow was related to all of these intermediate drivers via these mechanisms. And then they had different responses across the estuary. So it's not the same story in all corners, right? And there's some parts of the Bay Delta, the Susun Delta region that have very different effects. And the two that really stand out is the responses in Susun Marsh are very different than the responses in South Central. And so the ecosystem responses that they were able to tie in here that were pretty profound were things like phytoplankton responses and zooplankton responses. And again, those are the little critters at the base of the food web. You can see there that they have in the arrow, it goes going back, and it's not in one direction. The phytoplankton response was very different in Susun versus South Central. For example, the graphic here is showing you that the phytoplankton is having, it's basically getting increased in South Central region, but it's actually being decreased in Sassoon Marsh under these drought conditions. And the reason for this is the longer residence time in the South Central area is leading to greater phytoplankton blooms and greater zooplankton availability, again, base of the food web. But you can see by the little circle there too, that what you're, there's all the community change, that it's not the same phytoplankton and it's not the same zooplankton. Things are changing because of salinity increases in the South Central, and then also in Sassoon. And the point here is that the spatial responses are so profound that we need to start talking about these regions very in a very clear way as being having different responses to drought. I can go through sort of, you know, a lot of the work that was done, but the key points here is that it supports the hypotheses that have been talked about for quite a while and are modeled often, but this was done with data. This was actually done with long-term records. And they point to that this is somewhat of a new normal because three of the drought records are within the last 20 years. And so because this is becoming, if you look at the Sacramento Valley Index going back in time, we've had about seven of these drought events that show up in that record. And three of them within the last 20 years alone. And so it would be it's hard now to tease apart, for example, what's causing a pelagic organism decline, because there's these drought influences that we can tie through here that could be part of the pelagic fish decline, which is basically all the smelt and the striped bass and so on. And there's also a decrease in salmon returns. So the reason I'm telling you this is that they're not saying they're not pointing to a solution. What they're pointing to is the need to consider drought effects on a regional basis and have the data to support tracking this so that we can have appropriate responses. And then I think I can get into the details a little more if you have any questions, but the paper is so well laid out and it's in the San Francisco Estuary and Watershed Science Journal, which we help support. And it is it's basically a team effort that's really impressive, a very strong Delta Science program component here, where a lot of the data sets were actually pulled together by staff and also some of the team, the 24 members of the drought synthesis team. Several of them are Delta Science program staff. I guess the last thing to plug about this paper is that it's in a special issue that also relates to other specific drivers within these same concerns here, gets into some of the species shifts. But then also there is going to be a State of the Bay Delta Synthesis Project coming out, publication, again, led by Maggie Christman, led by our team here, the Delta Science Program. And the lead author of this paper, which is Rosemary Hartman, is also a lead author on a key chapter in that State of the Bay Delta Science, again, dealing with drought effects and then taking it through to sociological impacts as well. So I should say socio-ecological impacts as well. So yeah, I'm happy to take any questions on this paper that might be interested in.
It just made me start thinking about all of the discussions we've had about the harmful algae blooms and predictions and all of that. So I'm curious if there's some overlap there. You know, when we had our presentations related to Delta Adapts, a lot of the focus was on the high water events, the flooding that could possibly happen. And I keep asking, what's the deal as far as these drought events, because at the same time, we could be seeing sea level rise, which also contributes to saltwater intrusion and all of those things. So I'm glad that I'm going to read more just to kind of understand that. But it also made me wonder, what are the impacts on the Delta following a drought when you get the high water? How long is there a recovery time, or is there permanent damage for a longer period of time? You know, I'm just curious about that. What is the recovery and all of that? So it just made me think, but I appreciate you sharing all this.
Yeah, I don't have a specific answer to the recovery time. I will say that they analyzed the record for droughts, signals against these multi-year drought events and wet year events, multi-year wet years events. And then the third category was neutral, like neither one. So it's just, you know, kind of up and down. And so they don't talk about a lag time, but it's the kind of thing that now can be analyzed because they pulled together this huge data set and we can start to ask those questions about recovery and so on. And, you know, I'll actually bring that up with Rosemary Hartman for her chapter in the State of the Bay Delta.
Because on there it said the intermediate drivers. And I was like, a lot of those are related to the harmful algae blooms, you know? Yeah. So when we start to see water temperature and lack of flow and all of that, is that part of the effects that we're seeing more of those because of the recovery is not necessarily happening as much as we would hope it would?
Very likely.
Yeah.
Very likely. But yeah, the data that they use for the harmful algal, I'm sorry, for when they say community composition is changing in the South Delta, it's primarily the data they have on Microcystis, which is a harmful blue-green algae, but it's a cyanobacteria, to be clear. But it, you know, the more monitoring would actually that we can do, the better we can increase that data set, because this is lumped data. This is basically June, July, August, and September, October, November, and right. You know, because that's how you when you start harmonizing data, you have to look at bigger chunks of time. And so it might be that we can get some finer details on times of bloom and how it's exactly related to flows.
So it's exciting to hear that everybody's finally getting all that data and thinking in those bigger pictures. Thank you.
You had mentioned that there were three droughts in the last 20 years and that they'd looked at seven altogether. How far back does the data go?
Yeah, the earliest drought they looked at was the 1929 to 1937 drought. So that's a monster. That's 8 years. Yeah. but yeah, so from there, I mean, I just kind of wrote them down. But from there, there was the 1944 to 1950 drought, then the 1959 to 1962 drought, then the 1976-77 drought, we might be familiar with, 87 to 92, and then the last three big ones that they have here is the 2001 period, the 2007 through 10, and the 2012 through 16. So that's all they've looked at. They didn't look at the most recent, but this is the data set they were able to pull together. Got
it. Very interesting. All right. Any other questions from members? No. Is there anything else on your report, or are we ready to go to public comments?
Yes, there is, okay. Madam Chair. Thank you. So let's perhaps talk about some of the work that's been done this past month. One of the big things we did was present the cyanobacteria harmful algal bloom monitoring strategy at the DPIC meeting, the Interagency Committee for Delta, the DPIC meeting, I should say, the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee. And so at that meeting, we released, we was just coming back the comments back from a 30-day review period. Staff is currently working all those comments and comments from DPIC into the new final to be released monitoring strategy that will come out this summer. We have presentations there by Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Water Resources. Or I should say the presentations were from State Water Board and DWR and Tricia from Delta Science Program. And so, and Ellen Priest, I should say, from Department of Water Resources. But the authors of the monitoring strategy include Fish and Wildlife, for example, and Environmental Science Associates. So anyway, that will be coming out this summer. And again, it was endorsed. Yes, the word is, it was endorsed by DPIC at the meeting. I'm sorry about that. And so again, that'll be coming out this summer, and look forward to socializing that even more. The next thing that happened was the Delta Research Awards were, the solicitation request was posted, and the due dates for those research awards have shifted. So now the due dates for the letters of intent are now due on May 28th. So people have a little bit more time. That means basically next week. So letters of intent are required for this call. And again, it's a co-production focused call for research awards that are targeted to specific components of the science action agenda. And the other thing that came out, or I should say before I go into the other things that have just been released, let me talk about peer review, because that's the third topic to discuss. So our staff just completed a peer review for the Bureau of Reclamation on their fish and aquatic effects analysis. And it's a really important feature of the Delta Science Program that we do these independent reviews that are extremely transparent. You can go to the website for the peer review section, and you're going to get a highlight on this in June. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the peer review function, but it's important. This one just got released. It's actually going to be presented to National Academies of Science shortly by the lead author on it. And all the charge, the documents, thousands of pages, 37 models, 6 endangered species reviewed. I mean, it's a really huge thing. And so it's on the website, and you can look at it. Some of the overarching comments were they're impressive, how impressed they were with what BureauRec had pulled together. And also encouragement of them to continue doing this. And then the third, concern about time steps in some of the data that they were using. So there was a good amount of analysis that goes into this, but I again highlight that you can look at that, and you'll hear more in June. The next thing to highlight would be the things that it should be on your radar. And that includes the Delta Science Fellowships, which we just released, again, that call. Applications for that are due June 24th, so there's a little bit of time there. Letters of intent, are necessary prior to the final due date. State of the Estuary Conference, where we, again, the science program has a huge presence, has been pushed till next week, as the executive officer just mentioned. Next week also is the Coastal and Marine Science Institute day-long workshop on food webs that we, again, have a significant role in, and that's at UC Davis in partnership with them, and specifically on, food webs across a very wide range of habitats and trophic levels. So it's a very broad food web conversation about modeling. The next thing to highlight is the Bay Delta Science Conference, which has its request out right now for abstracts, and those are due now June 3rd, which is next week, or at least a little over a week. And so I want to make sure folks know to apply for that. That's going to be September 30th through October 2nd at the SAFE Convention Center. And cultivating connections is the theme. So there'll be, quite a strong outreach to getting as many community members as we can to be in attendance. And that is the end of my report, except for the by the numbers data. So perhaps we can turn to the by the numbers, and then we can take any questions. So the good thing about what you're looking at is the fact that there's just no surprises. So it looks so much like the data from April that I hardly even want to mention that there's change, because there's like virtually no change. Everything's relatively high. Still, the reservoirs are high, flows are high. You can see in the graphic at the bottom, the Sacramento River, San Joaquin River, and the Central Valley Project and State Water Project diversion data, that those numbers are almost identical to what they were in April, except for the Sacramento River has actually dropped by about 30%. But again, it's still over 100% of its historic flow. So it's just, it was flowing even higher, but it's just flowing high. So that said, the other thing you'll notice is we're not talking about snow anymore. So we've pulled that graphic out and we're talking about temperatures. And the temperatures at these particular locations, again, just sort of bracketing the range of conditions in the Delta, are pretty much exactly what you would expect from the historical record. So no real story there. And the same is true from precipitation, or I should say rainfall, that's occurred this far this year. It's basically about normal from what's expected. So just really no big surprises on this data, but it's nice to have to be able to look at.
Very nice. Does anyone have any questions? No? Thank you very much. Emma, do we have any public comment?
Yes, we have an online public comment from Deirdre Desjardins. You should be able to speak now.
Yeah, Deirdre Desjardins, California Water Research. So my research background is in nonlinear dynamics and complex systems theory, and I've been working on climate adaptation for the last over a decade. And there's some new cutting edge research that shows that the decade long droughty period that we've seen since 2013 or 14 is related to shifts in the Pacific Ocean. And we're now understanding that those climate shifts were partly forced by greenhouse gases and aerosols. And the thing that was really striking was there is some new very high resolution modeling which shows that the forcing has changed, and it's forcing it towards a pattern that's warmer in the eastern Pacific, El Nino-like, a warm Pacific decadal oscillation, and it's a much wetter pattern. So I've gotten this information to Rosemary Hartman and the Delta Independent Science Board, and I'm disseminating it. But the Delta ecosystem could shift back to a wet regime if we see this new climate shift. And I've been advocating for to build connections with the climate research community, and particularly with the pattern effect researchers who are doing this research that's just incredibly important for understanding our North American hydroclimate. So I got you the information. It's a bit technical. It's sort of on the fly. I've been advocating for the Delta Science Program to consider and incorporate this research. It's not being done by some of the Scripps Institute researchers that people most commonly interact with, the Delta Science Program most commonly interacts with, like Daniel Kyan. But Daniel Swain agrees that the research is incredibly important and very significant. And there's a number of pattern effect researchers, not only at Scripps, but at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. So, and Robert Jenklin Wills, who was leading some of this groundbreaking research, although he's at ETH Zurich, He grew up in Martinez in the Delta and is interested in this as well. So I got you the information and I got it to Lisa Marie, and I hope we can forge connections in the climate research community as well as in the local community. Thank you.
Thanks for that information. All right, we're going to move on to agenda item number 10, which is our Delta Levees Investment Strategy Risk Reduction Analysis. And I'll introduce our DSC staff, Aaron Mullen, Supervising Engineer, and Ashok Bethula, Senior Engineer.
Hello? Is this getting me?
Yep.
Okay, good. I couldn't hear myself. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for inviting us to present today. As Chairman Julie pointed out, my name is Aaron Mullen, and this is Ashok Bethula, our senior engineer. I know that we are running short on time, and we kind of have a full agenda beyond this, so I'm going to attempt to be brief, even though this is a very complex topic, so hopefully I can strike the right balance there. Okay, next slide, please. All right, so this presentation is going to take place in three parts, where I'm going to discuss a little bit of background on the D-list so that you understand what we're doing and why we're doing it. I'm going to then hand it over to Ashok, who's going to talk about the analysis that we conducted, and then I will wrap it up with what we learned. So next slide. Actually, next slide. So as always, we have to start with the Delta Reform Act. D-List was developed in response to the Delta Reform Act, Water Code 85306, which directed the council to develop priorities for state investment in Delta levees operation, maintenance, and improvement. The project, D-List, began in 2014, but it took 10 years for the regulation to formally go into effect. Next slide. So 10 years may seem like a long time to develop a regulation, and it is, but the Delta is a complicated place with many competing interests, and the council took a methodical, iterative approach to develop the prioritization, and it was based on collaboration, coordination, and best available science. D-List started with an issue paper that identified state interests. It then went on to develop a methodology that quantified the risks and develop a platform where the council and the stakeholders could have a transparent and public dialogue around strategic investments in those risks. The methodology uses a decision support tool to assess risk and identify investment strategies. The weight of each state interest is set by the council. I will talk about this a little bit more on the next slide. The decision support tool informed the council and laid the foundation for the prioritization that became law when the regulation went into effect. In addition to prioritizing levy investments, the D-List regulation also identified operations and maintenance as a universal priority, and it created a reporting structure for public review of state investment decisions made by the Department of Water Resources, or DWR. Oops, next slide. I'm going to take a minute to dive deeper into the decision support tool, or the DST, because that is really the meat of what we're going to be talking about today, is our analysis using the support tool. The council defined risk as the probability of an event times the consequences of that event. For example, an urban area might have a lower chance of flooding compared to an agricultural island, but the consequences if it were to flood would be much higher. The risk associated with a levee failure can be much greater with an urban center, even if the odds of it flooding are not that high. To calculate the risk, the DST uses an island's estimated levee strength against high water events and seismic activity. In other words, if there is a flood or an earthquake, do we think that the levees will hold? And if we don't, what does that mean? What is the risk? The council sets the threshold for how much risk we should tolerate. Risk cannot be eliminated, but we can aim to protect against events that would have the biggest consequences first. The tolerable risk for loss of life is lower than what would be acceptable for a flooded roadway. The Delta is a dynamic place, and as new information becomes available, the DST is updated, and that can and will change the prioritization. For example, if an urban area improves its levees to the required 200-year that, you know, that Deidre had actually mentioned earlier, the level of protection being required by the state, then it's no longer a priority to continue to improve its levees. The DST informs the prioritization, but it doesn't set it. The council reviews the output and can make manual adjustments when it deems necessary. And now I'm going to hand it over to Ashok, who's going to discuss the report that we've received from DWR in December.
Next slide, please. DLIS investment strategy. DLIS is an important framework that directs. Can you guys hear me?
Now. While you did, is there an actual the report? Is it connected? Because I'm not seeing it. Maybe I'm not looking in the right place.
So there are two different reports. I'm not sure which one you're asking about. Are you asking about the DWR? That we didn't include that in the package this time, but it is on our website. It was presented in December.
Okay, it's this. So this report's based on that.
Yeah. Okay. So this is our analysis of the data that they gave us.
Right. Okay. You guys hear me okay? Okay. Guys hear me okay? Okay. All right. DLIS is an important framework that directs public resource investments towards levy improvements in the Delta. You know, these priorities are based on a three-tiered system that we developed. All the islands in the Delta are categorized into very high priority, and other priority. By guiding these investments according to these priorities, we can address the most critical islands first before moving on to the next one. I think, well, everybody agrees this is important because our investments or resources are limited, so we need to be strategic where these resources or money goes. Next is the annual reporting. Like Erin mentioned, like, you know, DWR is required to submit, per the DLIS regulation, DWR is required to submit an annual report to the council. This report not only helps the council, but also the public to keep track of where all the investments are going in the Delta. Content requirements. DLIS regulation is pretty clear on the content requirements. There are, like, you know, sections A through G that talk about, like, specific requirements. Some of these requirements, which I'm going to touch on, like, you know, the annual report must include decisions about, like, you know, funding decisions made by DWR. And it should also include descriptions of all the discretionary state funding awarded by DWR, a list of submitted project proposals and specifics of the awarded projects, such as funding levels awarded and local cost share. Additionally, the report should also document any changes to the levy geometry and the resulting changes to the flood protection standards. Last item, data for risk analysis. Obviously, the report should include all the necessary data that the council staff would need to run the risk analysis on. Next slide, please. Okay, next slide. Okay. That doesn't show up right. Okay. DWR in the report state that altogether they awarded funding to 24 levy improvement projects in the Delta, of which only four are completed, you know, during 2019, fiscal year 2019 through 2023. In this presentation, or in general, we are focusing on the completed projects because they're already on the ground functioning and we have good data to run our analysis on. The map, I don't know if you guys can, well, okay, yeah. The map, on the map, you see four islands. You know, Sherman Island, the whale-shaped, and Bethel Island are there to the western edge of the Delta, and they are part of the key 8 key Western islands that are important for water quality. And Terminus Island, Terminus Tract that you see on the eastern part of the Delta, it may not seem that important from water quality perspective, but really it is when the Delta cross channel gates are open, all that rich fresh water from Delta is diverted into a branch of McCollumee River that flows through the western edge of the Terminus Tract. If something were to happen, if a levee were to break in Terminus, that's gonna have a big impact on all the fresh water that's gonna flow to the water projects. A little background on the Delta cross channel gates. These gates are a vital feature of the Central Valley Project. They're located near Walnut Grove, and they are operated by Bureau of Reclamation. The gates are generally open during low flows, so water from Sacramento is diverted to the Central Delta. They're open during summer and fall months, but during winter times or when the flow is really high, over 20,000 CFS, the gates are generally closed. They do that because if the gates were to open, it would flood the Central Delta and also to protect salmon. Dutch slough that you see to the south of Bethel Island, it is located in the eastern Contra Costa County near Oakley. This site is really unique in the sense it has elevations varying from 6 feet to minus 6 feet, elevations above zero. You don't see that in Delta. Most of the Delta, as you know, is subsided. So these elevations are pretty good, well within the tidal range, so makes it a suitable location for tidal marsh restoration. Next slide, please. Okay. Sherman Island, because of where it's located and it's important to the water quality, it's a very high priority island, as I mentioned before. And you see under the list of state interests, there are more than one, water quality, ecosystem, and Delta as a place. I should note to everyone, if there are more state interests, obviously that island is going to make to the top tier. And rightfully so for Sherman, it's in the top tier. Water quality, this island acts as a natural barrier to salinity intrusion in the Delta. There is no such thing as natural, especially we know it's kind of man-made. But I should note that all the islands or most of the islands in the Delta are subsided. So even though I say Sherman acts as a natural barrier, it is actually the levee system around that island that is, that is important. That is the one that helps it act as a natural barrier.
Is that the one they call the cork in the bottle?
Yes.
An ecosystem, it is important for ecosystem. There is a diverse ecosystem in Sherman Island. There are about 2,000 acres of wetlands in Sherman. And Delta as a place, for anything to qualify as Delta as a place, which is a metric that we use, you have to check the box on three items, or at least one of the three. One, it's a legacy community. An island should have a legacy community, or it should have prime farmland, or the last item would be, important infrastructure such as state highways. For Delta or for Sherman Island, Highway 160, State Highway 160 runs through it, which needs protection from flooding. So the purple color line that you see, that is the project. It's about 6 miles. What they have done with the project that which you see and most of the projects is they have widened the levee and they have added fill on the land side and the water side to improve the stability and also reduce seepage, which is a common problem with the levees. Of the 6 miles, I think little over 1 mile, they raised the crest elevation, the height of the levee. But we didn't capture the tool when we ran through the tool, those raises are really modest. So we haven't seen much of a change in the risk metrics when we evaluated. So this project, as I should say, you would see more of the impact or the risk metric changes on the other island, but on this one, as I mentioned before, you don't see much of a change, but that doesn't mean that the improvements that they did is not important. You need to have these, like, you know, stronger levies or the wider base levies so that you can raise these levies in the future, which we all know we need it with the climate change and everything, the sea level rise, storm surges, and wind wave action or the wind wave run-up going on. We're gonna need to raise the levies. So next slide, please. Okay. This is Bethel Island, again, a very, you know, high priority island. Like when you look at the state interest at risk, you know, people that are 2,300, it is a legacy community. Like, you know, Bethel isn't Bethel Island, it's a legacy community. You know, 2,300 people live there. Property, you know, in addition to the, like, you know, Delta Grove or the properties, it has ag land that needs protection and water supply. It is one of the 8, you know, key Western islands. And I touched on Delta as a place. So the project itself, you see, again, it's highlighted in purple color. It's about like a mile, 0.95 miles to be exact. The project is a setback levee. They degraded the old levee, which meets like in a HMP or the basic standard, but it doesn't meet the highest standard, which is the Bulletin 19282. So they degraded that. They did a setback levee by setting the levee back on the land side, and they widened the base, you know. They widened the base and strengthened the levee overall. As I said, like, you know, that 1 mile segment is the one that has the highest flood protection standard. Like, you know, everything else, it has like an either a HMP or PL8499 standard, which is a lower standard compared to Bulletin 19282. As with most levee projects that I mentioned, like in addition to widening the base, one of the important feature is like, you know, at the levee crest, they have like, you know, all-weather access road, which is important for like, you know, levee patrolling and also during emergencies. And when we ran like metrics through the DST tool that Erin talked about, like, you know, you get like, you know, close to a dozen metrics, but we only pick the ones that are important here. You know, EAD, expected annual damages, and EAF, expected annual fatalities from probability of levee failure. You see, we are showing here a reduction, which is about like in a 45K. And these reduction or the damages include damages to the property, like, you know, vehicles, like infrastructure damages, crop losses, everything. And when it comes to expected annual fatalities, that number may seem low, but like, you know, it translates to about like, you know, one life saved in a 100-year event. And you're getting all of this with that just that, like, you know, 1 mile levee improvement. And the probability of levee failure as a whole for Bethel Island drops by like, you know, 1.6%. I should explain a little bit about this, the concept of EAD and EAF. So it is really clear. A 100-year flood, as you guys know, is set to happen on average like once every 100 year. And during that flood, if you have like in a $100 million in damages, EAD would be divide that $100 million by 100 year. So you get like in a $1 million per year in damages. Same goes for the expected annual fatalities. If in a 100-year event you have 10 fatalities, which means every year, or like on average in a given year, you have 10 divided by 100, so 0.1 fatalities per year. Next slide, please. Okay. Terminus track. I'll make this quick. You know, Terminus Track, it has like town of Terminus. It's important when it comes to, you know, property damage, you know, also has prime farmland. And as a Delta as place, like, you know, this qualifies or comes under Delta as a place because of State Highway 12 and prime ag land. So the project here is they basically added fill on top of the levee to like increase the height of the levee. And they worked on the weakest part of the levee. Because of that, you see, like, you know, most bang for the buck here. Like, you know, it's one of the most cost-effective projects that we have seen of all the 4 projects that we looked at. And when you look at the expected annual damage, there is a reduction of 230K per year, which is significant because, you know, the overall project cost is only like, you know, $2 million. And expected annual fatality or the reduction is like one life saved in a 100-year event. And the probability of levee failure for the whole system drops by 12%. Next slide, please. Dutch slough, which I touched on earlier, like, you know, it's from the restoration standpoint, it's a very important project. It's kind of unique. You know, you don't have these kind of lands, like, you know, in the Delta. It is truly a multi-benefit project in the sense it has the ecosystem restoration component. You know, it has the flood protection component, and it has, like, you know, public access and a recreation component. So to have, like, you know, the tidal action going on, what they have done is they made notches at 5 locations on the old levee so water can come in and flow out with the tides. And that's gonna help, like, you know, with the tidal marsh restoration efforts. And they build a brand new levee to the south of it. That's gonna provide 200-year level of flood protection, which is pretty big for the areas or the residential areas, you know, right to the south of the Dutch slough. We haven't had a chance, or not that we haven't had a chance, we were not able to do a comparison in the tool to before project to after project to see what kind of benefits we're seeing using the metrics that we use. Because of the configuration of the levees, so much has changed in the Dutch slough that we don't have a good baseline, but this project is going to set a new baseline in the future. Like, you know, we should be able to compare it. And now to you, Erin.
Thanks, Ashok. Okay. Next slide. All right. Next slide. Okay. In the interest of time, I'm just going to be short and to the point. If you take out Dutch slough, which is a significant effort, and it was part of EcoRestore, these projects only amount to $12.5 million of investment out of what we have identified as $1.3 billion of need. So it's really just a drop in the bucket. We didn't see huge reductions in risk because these were such modest projects. I think the takeaway from this is that we really the importance of continued investment. I don't need to belabor the point that there's just so much so many state interests in the Delta that need protection. Water supply, Delta's place, prime ag ecosystem, all of that. And the levees are really the backbone for the Delta. If you don't have the levees, you don't have a Delta. You have, you know, you have a marsh or you have Frank's Tract. So I think, you know, I just would really like to wrap up that continued investment is critical. When we make investments, we do see reduction in risk, but the amount of reduction is going to be commensurate with the amount of investment. So, and with that, next slide, please. And that concludes my presentation, and I open it up to questions.
Thank you. That was very informative. I really enjoyed that. Members, does anyone have any questions? I knew you would. I was just looking right at you.
So I really appreciate towards the end talking about the money, because that was one of my questions is, you know, how much are we talking about when we're talking about 4 completed projects out of 24 and how much that is? So that means there's, I'm guessing, about $1.2 billion that's still out there being worked on. And so the other question was, have we taken it from very high to a different? And the answer was, we can't judge that right now.
Correct? No, we did run that analysis, and these investments did not shift the risk significantly enough to change the current prioritization.
Yeah.
But I would like to point out, and I think Ashok touched on this, that
These were four projects out of 24. So there still are an additional 20 projects in the Delta that are being constructed right now, or at least in some point of development.
Right.
So hopefully as these projects are completed and do your reports on them, we will see, we will begin to see a shift, and maybe, and the prioritization may reflect that.
I know you can't speak on behalf of DWR, but is it a priority to start like with this lower hanging fruit to start removing some of these high priorities so that we can move the list around? Or I guess I can't ask you that question, but I'm going to just put it out into the universe. It would really be nice to demonstrate that we're actually reducing the risk. And, you know, I look at the Dutch Slough project as one that I was a advocate for 20 years since it was in my backyard. And while it's a beautiful project, I don't know, you know, I don't know the significance of, you know, the levee system on that project. I know with Bethel Island, there's a lot of low-income folks that live on an island that has very limited access and regress, and they're not only are they worried about the levees, but they also are dealing with the drainage issues within the island. And I think that's a significant issue in a lot of places, that not only are they worried about the water on the outside, but what to do with the water during these high water events, because there's nobody there necessarily to manage the drainage. And so you're dealing with flooding and drainage. And in my observation, there's always another interesting thing that's happening to make it even more interesting during those events. So, you know, I know Bethel Island, Sherman Island's really important because that's where the roadway goes from the Bay Area up to through the Delta, and same with Terminus. You've got, you know, it's an important part of the transportation system. And so I'm glad that it's, but then for you to say that it's only 12.5 million of 1.3 billion, it's kind of like, okay, so what are we solving here? Mm-hmm. You know, what reduction in risk to people, property, you know, water, all of those things. So good report. Thanks for eventually putting in those things that I was interested in, but I would really like to hear from Department of Water Resources their commitment to chart to really tackle these things. And again, on DLIS, there are levies that are not included as state interests that can get funded, but we really are still concerned about the subvention program going away, because you said by next year that might not be there. And so we still need to push on that.
Absolutely. And part of our regulation is that operations and maintenance is a priority no matter where it's happening.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense for us to invest in improving levees if we're not going to maintain what we already have on the ground. So you know, that continues to be a critical piece.
I'd like to see that 1.3 or 1.2 billion of what's being done. And the other thing is, in these reports, when you're talking about, I liked the way you did it, but can you include the populations of the people? Because it says people, mm-hmm. and that could be 100 people or that could be 10,000 people, depending on what your 100,000 people. And then the other is maybe a little more specific on property, because that helps us understand, you know, there's a campground or there's 20 homes or there's, you know, industrial or, you know, whatever it is. It'd be good just for us to be able to kind of, because a lot of these folks don't live on the Delta, mm-hmm. probably can't pick out each of these islands necessarily. And so it's good to kind of give that consideration when we're talking about it.
I appreciate that feedback. Thank you. So this is our first attempt at quantifying the reduction
in
risk.
Great.
And so I'm, you know, we can definitely incorporate that feedback into the report that accompanies this presentation going forward. So
you did great. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Shaq.
Yeah, thank you. I too just want to offer, like, this is really, really significant and fantastic work. I mean, until we sort of figure out what the risks are, we're not making decisions that are really grounded in and what needs the most help and when. So I just think it's phenomenally well done and really grateful for the time and do think that growing it and then hopefully seeing the decisions made as a result will be really fantastic. So thank you.
Yeah, to that point, I'd want to point out that all of these decisions, these funding decisions, were made before the regulation was in place. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing is legacy decisions now. The regulation went into effect on January 1st of this year. So going forward, the intent is that the prioritization will help inform DWR's decisions.
Yes, Member Huesa.
This presentation means a lot more to me, having been out there and seen that some parts of the levy are pretty interestingly below the level, or some parts of the delta are below the level of the river, and trying to understand the delta a little more in a historical context where maybe that wasn't so, let's say 100 years ago, maybe it was before we even had any kind of levee system controlling the outflow of the San Joaquin and the Sacramento rivers as they have. I mean, you hear stories about all of Sacramento being flooded in big rain events. So was it more usual along the delta in previous historical times to see major flooding where you would have seen Sherman Island, Bethany Island be completely submerged? Is that something that could have been possible?
Yes. I mean, there were times when they were completely submerged if there was a lot of water coming down the system. But historically, these were islands and not bowls. So over time, soil would deposit and tules would die and create soil. And that's what really created that the peat that makes it such rich farmland in the delta. So you can say that for a lot of the valley. I mean, the valley would mm-hmm. go through periods of flooding and drainage. But I would say that the delta was dry probably more often than it was submerged. So these were
naturally. Which is the case now?
No. Well, okay. they wouldn't be. If a levee fails in the delta and the island is below the river, it's going to fill up like a bathtub. So, and that is not what would have happened before.
And it wouldn't drain?
No.
So it would fill up like a bathtub and never drain.
Yeah, like Frank's Tract, for example, yeah. Delta is it looks like a lake, but it's a flooded island. It's permanently flooded.
Yeah. So when an island floods and is recovered, what they will do is engineers will, or the reclamation district, what have you, they will allow the island to fill up and create, like basically get to a place of equilibrium. And once that is stable, they will come in and fix the levee breach that was there, and then they will pump out the water. That's what happened in Jones Tract in 2004.
So assuming we have a 100-year rain event where we get like 4 or 5 inches mm-hmm. in a day, and one of those islands that's currently in a bowl configuration gets flooded, the only way to unflood it is to pump water out?
Yes. I would like to point out that over the last few decades, the only levee failures that we've seen actually have been sunny day failures. So Jones Tract, which happened in 2004, that was not in a high water event. So levees can fail in ways other than high water events. We've actually had a very good track record lately of being able to flood fight and protect the islands during high water events. So reclamation districts will get out there and monitor the levees, put sandbags on the levees, do what they need to do to keep the levee system intact.
So another way to strengthen the levees could probably be to widen them by bringing and importing maybe soils.
Absolutely. And actually, that was one of the things that Ashok was talking about. So that was part of the project in Sherman, was they more soil on the backside of the levee to strengthen it and reduce the chances that it will fail before it overtops.
And the overarching reason we're creating levees and protecting the islands is their agricultural productivity.
No. some of the islands have agriculture on them, but they're almost all a mosaic of a variety of state interests. So as, you know,
environmental habitat.
Habitat, water
that
quality.
Was how the historic delta was created, though.
Oh, yes.
I mean, there were federal programs that incentivized draining the land and reclaiming for agricultural purposes, and then the levees were built, and that created the mosaic that we have today.
Yeah, and most of the islands at this point are a part of the water distribution system. So the levees really protect our ability to keep salinity out and to get fresh water down to the pumps. So, you know, the levees are a part of the state water project in a sense.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, they create the channels the water to the pumps in the south.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And just... you know, we talk about seismic stuff, we talk about buildings, and on levees, similar to these other construction and industry thing, I'm not saying it very well. What we've learned about levees is how to do it better. Mm-hmm. And so we've learned how to, like a home that's built in the 1900s, it wasn't built for seismic activity, but we've learned ways to reinforce the foundation and do certain things to strengthen it. And at the same time, when we're building new buildings, we have lots of regulations and requirements to build stronger buildings. So we have that as far as our levees. There's some that are old that we are, you know, improving on. There's some newer ones that are replacing old ones. There's repairs that are done to kind of reinforce them. So I think is that accurate to kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, Randall Newdeck was presented to the council last month.
Yeah.
and with Metropolitan, and he spoke to that. I think one of the most interesting bits of levee technology that's happening right now are some of the sensors where, you know, that he spoke to, that where you can actually see in real time if a levee is moving and is at the risk of failure. It's possible that if we had that on Jones Tract, that maybe, you know, they could have gotten out there and reinforced the levee before it failed. There's lots of things that we can do to reduce risk in the Delta and support our water supply system and the ecosystem and all of the other state interests that we have.
But they all require a lot of money.
that is the limiting resource, which is why having a prioritization and being strategic with where we invest is so critical.
Okay. Any other questions from members?
Quick one.
Yes.
I remember that it was reported that we use LIDAR for, is that still a good tool for analysis that you're using for prioritizing which ones are?
So the council didn't use LIDAR. The Department of Water Resources used the LIDAR. So we used their data.
Their data.
Yeah, so we used their data. Thank you.
You had mentioned that there are 20 more projects ongoing in the Delta. Just to clarify that those projects were all probably planned prior to the D-list coming out as well. So that'll kind of be a common thread here for a while.
Yeah.
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 Okay. All right. Seeing no other comments from members, we'll go to public comment.
We have an online public comment from Deirdre Desjardins. You should be able to speak now.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that in evaluating Delta levee investments and risk reduction, that the council members and staff be aware that the Delta levees and investment strategy adopted by the council did not choose the option that prioritized investments in areas that had high risk to life or property. And the rationale was that this would not prioritize levee investments that provide ecosystem benefits. I did express my concerns about this in 2019, that putting water supply and ecosystem enhancement on equal footing with protecting life and property would result in vanishing funds for levee upgrades for the smaller vulnerable Delta communities. And I think it's really important to for people to be aware of the power imbalance here, and that there's, you know, enormous political weight towards you know, ecosystem benefits and towards water supply. But that doesn't address the equity issues. While they said there was an extensive public process, I am seeing that the concerns, and there were a lot of concerns expressed in the hearing on adoption of the Delta Levee Investment Strategy, are being lost. And one of the concerns was that it didn't prioritize risk to life or property. And again, this is like, if you're not aware of how the council processes are erasing this information or losing it, you're not going to be able to consider the equity issues that are being created. I do really appreciate it, and I understand there's a catastrophically low level of investment in the Delta, considering it's both the statewide and interests and the risk to Delta communities. So thank you very much, and I do appreciate the staff's work on this.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment. All right, we're going to move on.
Madam Chair, oh, yeah. We have an additional request for public comment from Gilbert Cosio.
Yes, welcome.
Hi, Gilbert Cosio again, River Delta Consulting.
Gilbert Cosio, River Delta Consulting. This discussion has got me thinking. I hadn't planned to comment on this. I saw the report in writing, and I thought it was good, and you guys made a good presentation. But this discussion afterwards about levies and that sort of thing, it's got me thinking that, you know, at some point, the council may want to have a workshop on levies. I mean, I've been doing it for over 40 years. So in my mind, you guys are fairly young as far as knowing about levies. There's a lot that goes into this information that you're hearing. You keep hearing Bolton 19282. That was a huge report. It was 10 years in the making. Both DWR and the Corps of Engineers worked on it. It's a joint project because the federal government, at the urging of the state, was thinking of having a levy program in the Delta. As it turned out, after they did all the engineering studies, they started doing the economics and didn't fit their economic benefit cost analysis. So it ended up the state is what published Bulletin 19282. And that's a design that we still use today. Some of the information that MWD brought to you last month, Randall Mudick and Russ Ryan, since that time and since other projects have gone on since then, we've improved on that design to the point where we're pretty confident that we can have some seismic resistance if we have enough money. As far as the money part of things, as they showed here, you know, for a few million dollars, they bought down a significant amount of risk. In the earlier stages of the DLIS, when Arcadis was your consultant, we started to talk to them quite a bit. And we determined that there's kind of a limit we can spend per year just because there was a cost share and the local farmers can't do a whole lot. And then in 2008, we put together, actually right before the DSC was formed, there was the process was called BudPAC, and we had CalFed and BudPAC and all these other processes going on. And Joe Grindstaff, the person that actually was the first person to kind of transition from BudPAC to the DSC, asked us, you know, we had just gotten this Prop 1E passed, and he asked, well, how much money do you guys need? And we put together in a weekend a nice paper to show if we had like $100 million a year, we'd cover everything, including this $1.3 billion, because we can't spend more than that per year. So it's the consistent funding that we need. And by doing that, I really like hearing the fact that these guys, your staff's looking at what do we need overall. But until we get that $1.3 million just to get to the basic
Fulton 18282. That's on top of it to keep up with the adaptation for sea level rise and climate change and that sort of thing. So at some point, you may want to spend a day just talking about this sort of stuff. Ask whatever questions, and you know, those of us that have been down there for quite a while can kind of answer it. There's a lot of history behind this stuff, a lot of politics. And I was fortunate, and Chris Newdeck, my counterpart down in Stockton, we kind of got pushed into this stuff at an early age. So we kind of learned trial by fire, but we got a lot of background in working on this stuff. So it's been really exciting, but we're still quite a ways off. And I'm semi-retired, and I really would like to fix the levees before I die. So that's my goal. So if you guys can help me with that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. All right, we're going to move on to agenda item 11. We're about 35 minutes behind on our time frame. So I'm going to introduce our Delta Water Master, Jay Ziegler, to report on his office's activities related to the implementation of the Delta. And I'm going to slash your time, Mr. Ziegler. I'm terribly sorry, but we're going to try to get through your presentation in about 15 minutes.
You know what? I think we can do that, okay. Madam Chair. So,
thank you.
Nice to see all of you today. Nice to be with the Stewardship Council. Thanks for this opportunity to catch up a bit. Next slide, please. So we're going to talk a bit today about the continuing efforts that my predecessor launched in 2017 to integrate water data reporting across the legal Delta. And there are some 1,300 water rights holders across the legal Delta and 2,700 points of diversion. The project that we have been working on is the deltaacp.com, which is an OpenET-based reporting system to try to get everybody across the Delta reporting with the same data methodology, and through that process to better understand consumptive use actually in real time. And I feel like that the bet that my predecessor Michael George placed in 2017 on OpenET is really paying off. We're really getting extraordinary buy-in to this platform, it's really been quite encouraging to see levels of reporting. Next slide, please. Bringing 80% of water rights holders across the Delta that divert more than 10 acre feet of water are participating in this unique platform. And the credit for that goes to really to the process that my predecessor created, creating an all stakeholders forum and the Delta Measurement Experimental Consortia, bringing together all water users across the Delta, water attorneys, NASA, Environmental Defense Fund, a wide diversity of interests, individual farmers, to really buy into this methodology and to stay with it now into water year 22, again, reaching roughly 80% reporting rates. We're hopeful, and we've now integrated both statement and appropriative license reporting in the platform. We had some challenges with the software, so we're still catching up a bit. We're at roughly 90% reporting for the current water year with respect to statements, about 80% with respect to appropriative rights. So we're really getting a much better accounting of water use and place of use across the Delta, both individually aligned as well as more holistically across the system. And this is essential as we think about governance of the Delta, especially during drought, and to better have a shared understanding of actual consumptive use in real time in the Delta. And so I'm deeply invested in this platform. As I've said, there's no plan B really for this methodology. I mean, we really have to make this work. I think Metropolitan had recently completed a study that it would cost between $10,000 and $20,000 to put a siphon gauge on the points of diversion. So as you run that math, you have 2,700 points of diversion. That's you're at 27 million. And then if it's 20,000, you're at 54 million to create a reporting platform. That's just not cost feasible. So
I was going to say, Jay, if you could explain why is it alternative? It's alternative to installing
actual gauges, right? This is driven by SB Senate Bill 88, which was adopted in 2014 to really drive legal reporting responsibility for all water users in California. And so that's based on actual diversion data. And in order to get to an alternative compliance program, you have to make, as my predecessor did, findings of infeasibility. So both the economics and the data proved to be wildly unreliable through siphon reporting. But Jessica, thanks for that. That's an important clarification that we're using an alternative methodology because the ability to implement a gauging program across the Delta has heretofore been provided unreliable data largely, as well as it's in an infeasibility with respect to the cost of compliance. So next slide, please. I've been asked to talk a bit about the recent workshops of the State Board 3 weeks ago in conducting a three-day public workshop on the voluntary agreements to comply with the update of the State Water Quality Control Plan. This is a three-day forum involving public water agencies, six different panels, multiple perspectives, including tribal governments, non-governmental organizations, and other stakeholders, really for the first time kind of coming together for a discussion of the voluntary agreements. To put this in context a bit, the long arc of time, this process is driven really fundamentally by two major statutes, the Federal Water Quality Act of 1972 and Porter-Cologne state statutes, which really drive water quality objectives systematically on a statewide basis. The last meaningful update of the Water Quality Control Plan for the San Francisco Bay Delta was 1995. That was updated in 1999 and 2006. In 2018, the State Board also adopted the first part of a Water Quality Control Plan Phase 1 for the San Joaquin River, which established a 40% unimpaired flow standard and an ability to meet that standard with a voluntary agreement for the San Joaquin or the Southern Delta tributary as well. And that 40% standard for unimpaired flow, which would be flow as it occurred in the system naturally, where they're not a network of dams above the system, was actually recently upheld in court in a decision that addressed some 130 claims and found in favor of the State Board across that spectrum of issues. So affirming the board's authority to implement an unimpaired flow program to protect beneficial uses of water, especially for fish and wildlife, which we know to be in substantial and precipitous decline in the last 50 years. And so contextually, these hearings addressed flow and non-flow objectives, provided an overview of the objectives that could be achieved in the process, flow measure accountability, accountability for habitat metrics, governance and participation in the process, as well as accountability and transparency in how the program would be governed. I should note that the hearings were kicked off by Department of Water Resources Director Carla Nemeth, and other she was followed by other proponents of the agreement. And the not so subtle charge of the proponents and in addressing the need for a voluntary agreement is the reality that were we to move to an unimpaired flow standard, there needs to be a consideration of proportional water rights and the contribution to additional flow. And out of that would ensue litigation that would take 8 to 10 years. As a proponent for the voluntary agreements, the administration was very clear that they want to see action on a faster timetable, and they would not want to see a delay of 8 to 10 years in litigation around an impaired flow standard. So that's contextually a framework for the 3-day hearings. Next slide, please. And among the issues that were highlighted in these 6 different workshop sessions, and again, this was really more than 20 hours of public engagement and that are linked on our website, and I could provide resources to you all to kind of dig in and see the actual discourse during those hearings. But, we are in a position where existing flow standards are based upon D1641 as updated in 2006, and the endangered species protections for salmon, steelhead, and the pelagic fisheries in the Delta. And so the key issue is how much of the discussion during the workshops was how do we actually measure and account for the additional flow contributions in the estimate of 500,000 acre feet to outflow. And so how do we validate that? How do we actually track whether or not there is an additionality of flow that benefit fish and wildlife, and a broad discussion of that? So that's an area for board staff follow-up and for further discussion. And additionally, the proponents of the voluntary agreement highlight the importance of establishing intertidal and floodplain habitat to help bring salmon back from the brink. And there was discussion about the uncertainty of both permitting and funding for habitat activities. And so those are areas for follow-up activity in specifically digging in and determining how we can actually, how the board would enforce the delivery of those habitat programs when there is inherent uncertainty around funding to do this work and permitting of the projects in order to get construction underway. Another big area of discussion was the board's role and responsibility. The proposal for the voluntary agreement is an 8-year term. And during that process, if the agreement is successful and we see the system responding with better water quality, better habitat, better fish population response numbers, what is the role for the board in this? What is the regulatory backstop by contrast if it doesn't work? When should that backstop kick in? Is that the current proposal recognized kind of a 6-year first window and for the board in reviewing the adequacy of the voluntary agreement in addressing conditions in the system? And so that's a further area for follow-up, because there's a lot of uncertainty about what happens in year 8. Does the program continue, or is there a regulatory backstop if the program isn't successful? And so those are were some of the key areas. And then within this mix of habitat and flow objectives, how do we discern better annual accounting for smart, time-bound performance delivery objectives within the plan? And how are those specifically built into the program? There was a significant discussion across the board on the need for addressing issues that have been raised by the United States Environmental Protection Agency with regard to harmful algal blooms and cyanotoxins in the system, which we all know are more prevalent today and a greater risk to human health and safety, as well as other beneficial uses of water that we are trying to protect. And what are the tribal beneficial uses in the Sacramento-San Joaquin watershed that we've far too long ignored? And how do we integrate those tribal beneficial uses better? And so I think that both the board and project proponents expressed a commitment to more a deeper engagement with tribal communities, tribal governments, NGOs, and fishing interests in mapping out objectives for the plan. And so I will say, you know, again, I wanted to give you this perspective of how this is a fraught process. I think it's significant that the board just won a significant court decision with respect to its authority in implementing a water quality control plan update. At the same time, virtually all the plaintiffs are together in appealing that decision. So we'll see how that moves forward. But I think it's important, just in looking at these issues, to really think about the importance of strengthening and refining components of the VAs and the regulatory backstop, recognizing that the immediate concern is the continuing steep trajectory and the loss of spring run, winter run. 2 years ago, the director of the Fish and Wildlife, Department of Fish and Wildlife, asserted that it would be meritorious to list fall run today. And the salmon season has now been closed for both sport fishing and commercial fishing 2 years in a row. So that gives us a pretty clear indicator of the stress in the system as we try to deal with this 21st century hydrology in a way that we just haven't been prepared for, and the need for fundamentally better science and monitoring throughout the Delta. And I think that throughout this process, I think you will hear from the Delta lead scientist and certainly from the state board and my office that this is essentially an 8-year experiment. If the board were to approve a voluntary agreement to achieve the objectives of a water quality control plan update, and there's a long journey ahead. Board staff offered that they thought it would be feasible to get back to the board with a program for implementation and enactment of a water quality control plan update probably by the third quarter of 2025. So that's not this year. That's the third quarter of next year. And I think VA proponents pushed back fairly strenuously. They would like to see action by the board in the first quarter of next year. And so we've still got a pretty significant journey ahead of us. There's going to be a great deal of deliberation with respect to the elements of the program for implementation to achieve the objectives of a water quality control plan. And I think it's helpful for the council to think about a water quality control plan update and the objectives that we need to achieve in that, and then to think about a voluntary agreement or an unimpaired flow approach as the pathway to achieve the goals of that water quality control plan. So we're embarking on a complex, fraught, legally fraught journey, and I think that my aspiration would be that the Office of the Delta Watermaster, the Bay Delta Division at the board, and the Council and the Delta Science Program can work collaboratively to develop a more transparent, robust, and accessible understanding of the science driving regulatory action in the Delta. And again, I feel like we are in an experiment here. And if a voluntary agreement is adopted, we need to learn as much as we possibly can about the complex water quality dynamics related to flow conditions in the Delta over the next 8 years. And so with that, let me entertain your questions today.
Thank you for that presentation. I'll just echo what you said about science collaboration. It's been a topic here for a bit, and I think that everyone is very interested in a robust science collaboration. So I'll open it up for any members that have any comments or questions.
Mine is really brief. So we're interested, actually, I don't want to speak for you, but we just in how we make all of the information going into these systems open source so that anyone can use them in terms of our science exploration. Do you coordinate with all of us on that, and especially our lead scientists, just making sure that any data you have, that it becomes part of a larger system and we can all benefit from it, anyone who's interested in learning about the Delta?
Let me echo. Yes, we are coordinating, and we're also in an environment in which there are multiple models that are in some ways seeking to validate each other's inputs and hypotheses in the system. That is a very complex charge, actually. And yes. And I will just take this, the data integration part and water data reporting that we are doing at the board in providing a more transparent window and water rights. Like, I am neither an engineer nor a scientist by training, but it's almost impossible to believe that the OpenET integration for water reporting began in 2017, and it took until 2022 to develop the software program to bring that all together. And so I think Councilmember Miller, I feel like what you have your finger on exactly what we need to be achieving. And I think it's important that we continue to revisit how accessible is the data and to really listen to stakeholders who are having problems accessing the data and or seeing conflicting results in the modeling. Because I think we have to accelerate our ability to get to more open source data that has a user-friendly pathway into the door as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Amber Burgess?
Yeah, and it's funny because I think as we collect that data, it's going to help us with the predictions and, you know, learning how to deal with it. And I think technology is coming along that's going to be able to assist us in analyzing what's going on and how to fix it and prediction models. So I think it's kind of an interesting time to have all this data, even though we're living in times that we typically can't depend on predictions because there's everything's so unusual. And then, you know, we were talking about how do we determine recovery after drought events? And so that was kind of what I was hearing from you is, you know, how do we define, okay, now we're good, now we can go forward and, you know, with a different approach. So I think that data is really important. One of the questions that came up when you're talking about water reporting and the gates and all the different things is, so I have a meter on my water that comes to my house. And so I pay based on what comes in. And so whatever's coming in is what I'm paying for. But say I have, and I have had an issue with my sprinkler system and I use way too much water. Or what if there's a leak? Do all water reporting, is it just the amount of water they're receiving? Or because I was thinking of the water project, there's leakage and there's evaporation. So are they paying for what's coming through the gate or what's being emitted? Or is it what actually gets to wherever it's being delivered?
So it's a little different in different areas of the Delta. So across the three Delta water agencies, the North Delta Water Agency in the northern part of the Delta actually pays pursuant to a contractual settlement with the Department of Water Resources that was initiated in the early 1980s. And so there is a cost associated with water diversions in the North Delta. In the Central and South Delta, the historic pattern, as discussed in your prior panels today, mm-hmm. has been that the landowner takes responsibility for maintenance of those diversions and reporting on those diversions, and they draw that water. In essence, without charge, but they will immediately point out that on many of the islands, the bill to pump water off the islands is $1 million a year, and they have significant costs in continuing levee maintenance. And so it's a bit of a different dynamic there. Yeah. Now, what we are monitoring in OpenET is to really, at a very fine scale, monitor evaporation and transpiration of the plants across the Delta in different crop types. And so what we're really trying to discern is how much water is getting used on an island, on a particular field in the island, and roll all that up across the Delta to see exactly how much water is getting pulled out of the system. And so the unreliability of the gauging data from both diversions as well as return flow pumping is an area that this Delta Measurement Experimental Consortium is continuing to work on to kind of true up the diversion data alongside the ET data, if you will, to really get a clear accounting of who's using how much water where across the Delta. And so and we're only measuring in the ET program, then we're only talking about the 415,000 to 450,000 irrigated acres across the Delta. It's, you know, there's another class of reporting for municipal and industrial use as well.
Yeah, I forgot about the pumping part.
Yes.
But yeah, to me, it was interesting to think about how do you measure that where? So
yeah.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Do we have any public comments, Emma?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have an online public comment from Deirdre Desjardins. You should be able to speak now.
I just wanted to note that the modeling for the voluntary agreements all was based on largely on the 20th century hydrology, and new research is showing we're not in the 20th century hydrology anymore, and that part of it is anthropogenic forcing. So it's a major gap, and unfortunately the peer review request by the Water Board didn't ask for review of climate change. And so it's a huge issue about whether this is going to be effective. And I wanted to point out that at the same time, there are proponents are in the voluntary agreement process. They're also, the state water contractors are also proposing in the separate Delta DAPS process that the Water Board consider changing human beneficial use objectives in the Delta due to climate change, and saying that they don't think they can be met anymore. So this is fundamental. The Water Board is in both processes, and it's fundamentally an issue, this kind of separation. I hope that going forward, more of it can be addressed, but it's a huge science gap. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ziegler. Appreciate your presentation. Thank you for keeping us on track with our timing, too. It's wonderful. All right. Our next agenda item is 12, the Pacific Flyway Center project presentation. And we are going to hear from Ava Bush, Environmental Program Manager, and Veronica Cornett, Pacific Flyway Center project manager. And we're still about 10 minutes behind, so I'll ask you guys to hit your highlights and leave some time for members to ask questions if you can get through that. Thank you.
And this is on. Okay, can you hear me? Good afternoon, Chair Lee and council members. Oh, sorry. That's okay. That's why I couldn't hear myself. I'm here to introduce the next agenda item, the update on the Pacific Flyway Center project, located in the city of Fairfield on the edge of Sassoon Marsh.
I was first introduced to the idea of the center in 2018 when I was in the science program, so I'm excited to see it started. And today we'll receive an update from project staff and Veronica here at the Pacific Flyway Fund on the progress and status of the project to date. So next slide, please. A certification of consistency for the project was filed with the council in May of 2021. By the City of Fairfield as the certifying agency and the lead CEQA lead. The project proponent of the covered action is the Pacific Flyway Fund. And the certification closed on June 3rd, 2021, without appeals, and then went on to implementation. Usually after certifications are completed, we rarely hear from projects again and lessons learned are lost. So today, we have invited the Pacific Flyway Fund to present on their implementation progress. A recommendation to invite certifying agencies back to present updates now is also in the 2024 draft five-year review, which is currently out for public comment. Next slide, please. So phase one of three of the project started in July 2023 and began with the Walk in the Marsh outdoor experience and will be followed by the Visitor Center building. And here today to tell us more about this and the rest of the project is Veronica Cornett from the Pacific Flyway Fund.
Thank you very much. Next slide, please. All right, perfect. Thank you. So my name is Veronica Cornett, and I am with the Pacific Flyway Fund. I am the one sole project manager for this project with one other, Claude Grillo. He's the director. A little bit of history around this project. Some of you may look at the slide and say, who is Ken Hoffman? He was a developer in the Bay Area, a huge conservationist, a hunter. But more so, he was a philanthropist. He was the previous owner for the Oakland A's, as well as the Seattle Seahawks. And what Ken wanted to do is he wanted to create an outdoor marsh wetland center for youth education, adult education, getting people outdoors and to be able to experience this very specific habitat. And when he went to the powers that be, whether it be our former governor or other political entities, they all told him the same thing. You couldn't really do this effectively in Durham, California on his 20,000 acre ranch. You needed to do this in the Sassoon Marsh. And so through a series of land swaps with the state and purchases from private owners, there began the almost 900 acre property, four parcels, all connected in an upland area right at the edge of the Sassoon Marsh in Fairfield, California, called the Pacific Flyway Center and the Walk in the Marsh. Why are we creating this? Well, there's a lot of reasons. I think we have a very short video. Next slide, please. You could hit that. There you go. And roll. Okay. It's about a minute. This is our video from 2018 that we developed for our website.
One of four flyways in North America, the Pacific Flyway is an aerial superhighway traveled by a billion migratory birds every year. It stretches 10,000 nautical miles from the Arctic to Patagonia. Central to the Pacific Flyway, the Sassoon Marsh northeast of San Francisco Bay provides a vital stopover for migrating birds. Adjacent to one of California's busiest freeways with more than 280,000 vehicles per day passing by, the Pacific Flyway Center, whose mission is to inspire conservation of the flyway, sits at an ideal interface between human culture and a globally significant natural area. In California, the Pacific Flyway is home to about 6 million waterfowl. The state lost about 95% of its historic wetlands to development before the decline was halted by far-sighted statutes such as the North American Wetlands Conservation Act. Today, more than half of winter habitat for waterfowl and shorebirds in California is provided by flooded rice fields and other managed wetlands, and the state has thousands of acres of inland and coastal wetlands like the Sassoon Marsh. A dramatic building with a form symbolic of wings of flight rises as a beacon to motorists and provides backdrop for visitors who get an introduction to wetlands and waterfowl as they approach. The buildings provide an acoustic and environmental buffer from freeway noise and overlook the main attraction, an outdoor park where visitors come face to face with waterfowl and other wetland birds.
All right, next slide, please. All right, perfect. Thank you. So obviously there's a little history behind this. Why are we creating this? I think it's pretty clear from the previous presentations that were done today. The environment for birds and wildlife in general is at a decline. And Ken wanted to create an area that was going to be a pristine habitat and really showing folks what would happen in a wetland marsh area. It's going to be a resting, nesting, feeding, breeding, multi-habitat area for these billions of not only the migratory birds, but also the endemic species and the wetland-dependent wildlife. Not to mention, we are going to be a conservation easement in perpetuity, and we have endangered as well as species of special concern, the salt marsh harvest mouse, the burrowing owl, and the western pond turtle. Who's going to use it? Well, obviously, we want everyone to use it, but we're really focusing on youth, primarily from the Bay Area and Solano County, where we're located. K through 12 students, academia, adults, families, wildlife watching, just getting out into the outdoors, habitat and wildlife research, and of course, migratory and native wildlife, including butterflies, to be able to experience this wonderland. Next slide, please. So what you're looking at here is the project mapping. This is the 124-acre mapping of the entire project. The blue amoebas that you see on the map are all the 24 acres of wetland ponds that are right now in phase one being created. These wetland ponds are approximately just shy of an acre or an acre and a half in size, and surrounding them will be the 3 miles of trails. We'll have a parking lot area and amenities, a restroom, shade structure, and things of that nature. Right now, as I said, we're in phase one. We're projected to open in 2027, preferably the spring. It might be in summer. What we'll see in the 2025 and 2026 years will be the planting of the trees, the seeds, the plants, really encouraging the flora and the fauna to create this great outdoor extravaganza. This particular area is previously, for the last 100 years or so, was upland grassland area used for agriculture and used for grazing of cows and sheep and things of that nature. So this is a complete and total transformation, which really doesn't get justice when you see it on an actual map. We do expect that we should have probably somewhere in the area in the first couple of years of around 10,000 visitors per year. Next slide, please. So obviously you can't do this without a lot of partners. Certainly the Delta Stewardship was our partner and still is our partner, and we're very fortunate to be invited here today. Some of the folks that we've been working with ongoing since 2015, California Waterfowl Association, Ducks Unlimited, National and Local Audubon, UC Davis, the Solano Resource Conservation District. International Bird Rescue is a very active and ongoing partner that we're working with. There's been a development of some youth curriculum, and they're bringing students out there from the fifth and sixth grade throughout the school season. And we've had a ton of support from local electorals as well as from the state and across the nation. And our first grant awarder has been the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta Conservancy. They gave us almost $2 million, and we'll be using that in phase one. We're at the point where we've started construction. We received all of our environmental permits, and we're actively working on grants. We have another full proposal right now into NIFWIF for about $700,000. And what are our needs? Our needs are just, we need volunteers. I need someone to help me with social media and a variety of other things, donations, going to events, doing presentations, and getting us to the finish line, which we're all very eager to do so that we can open up and greet our guests and get people to really enjoy what's going to be happening out there. Next slide. So the way I'd like to finish this up, knowing that this is going to be a three-phase project, as like the Monterey Bay Aquarium has taken over 40 years to get to a certain level, this will be in phases. The first part is the walk in the marsh, and that will be completed in 2027. Our first and next big endeavor will be in phase two, 28,000 square foot building. That in itself is going to be around $15 to $20 million. And then obviously the next phasing of an event center, a theater, and things of that nature. In this next slide, and then to open it up for some questions from all of you, is a drone shot that we took last year during the initial carving of those wetland ponds on the 124 acres. And so we're going to kind of roll through that. Like I said, you really don't understand how large this property is. So the 124 acres is nestled right in between the almost 900 acres that the Flyway Fund owns. But as you can see by the housing in the back and the little tiny cars that are going along 680, this is a pretty massive project. And like I said earlier, we're really very excited to be here today. I know I seem like I've had a lot of coffee. I had one cup this morning. This is how I am. This is how I wake up in the morning. But anytime I get an opportunity to tell people about this project, really brings joy and happiness, because while in my career, I wasn't a biologist or a scientist. I've done a lot of outdoor education with kids. I love that. It's my passion. This is my 2.0 portion of my career. But this is a labor of love. And I want to just get everybody excited, because I want to send this invitation out to all of you and your staff that you're welcome to come and visit. We'd like you to come and see it. I suggest maybe let's wait till about August or September till we get a little bit more done. But it's an open invitation, and we'd love to have you. So any questions? Because that was just really a very high level.
Yes, Member Zingali.
Your enthusiasm is contagious. That was a very exciting presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And on the social media front, we may be able to help with a tip. Just put Taylor Swift in some of your posts, and that's working for us. I was just wondering, because I am so excited about this, did you run into opposition, resistance? Is there still any of that? If so, how did you overcome it? Have you dispelled any of the concerns that came up? It just feels like to me like something this exciting couldn't have happened without some battles.
Well, in 2016, I believe the election cycle was it 2016 or 2018? It's all a blur. We had to have a city vote in the city of Fairfield in order to bring that portion of the property as part of the city. Okay. And in elections, sometimes there's a battle with that. But we were very fortunate. We did some outreach, and through the voting, there was a 76% vote, 76% to vote yes to annex that property into the city. That doesn't happen. So while there was a little opposition and people became very concerned that if we built and developed this land, that then immediately after that, there would be homes being developed and we were going to open up kind of Pandora's box. But we dealt with those questions and that pushback on an individual basis. And we assured them, especially because of the conservation easement in perpetuity, that what, as far as our property, that wasn't going to be a concern. And the majority of the properties that surround us are all duck clubs and agriculture. That doesn't mean in the future those things can't change in the zoning. But as far as the 900 acres, that isn't going to happen. This is going to be an outdoor education public access venue.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, Diane.
Are you getting any interest or pressure from solar or wind turbine folks that want to come nearby? And
we haven't as of yet. One of the components, and I would urge you all to go on our website, pacificflywaycenter.org. When you look at some of the renderings for our early iterations, it showed us with a very, very large winged building with a solar roof. What that looks like for us in the future, we're not quite sure. We want to make sure whatever we do is environmentally responsible. I don't see how wind turbine would be successful.
Oh, I mean, people are trying to build more wind farms and solar farms. Sure. And so the interaction between the wildlife and being in close proximity to those types of efforts, I just was wondering if there was a pressure coming from that kind of activity.
We haven't experienced that as of yet.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. Any other comments? No? Fascinating. I'm sure we will take you up on your offer to go out there and do a tour. And I really appreciate the follow through on seeing a project that's come to us and, you know, made it through the process. And then as you're starting to plan it and break ground, it's very exciting for us to see that whole big circle. So thank you very, very much for coming. We love
thank you
energy.
For having me. Have a great day.
Thank you. Do we have any public comment?
No, Madam Chair, we do not.
All right. Our final agenda item is preparation for the next council meeting, which will take place on June 27th here at the Resources Building. And we will post the meeting notice. So see that for further information or updates. Thank you.
Thank you.